Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music business, recording, and music production. And today we're going to have a special guest. He's an old friend of mine, studio bassist Paul Ill. Paul was in producer Linda Perry's studio band for a long time, and he's played on records for some major artists like Pink and Alicia Keys, Christina Aguilera, Tina Turner, and most recently, former Guns N' Roses drummer Matt Sorum. The other thing that's kind of interesting is Paul is a big proponent of the piccolo bass, and I think what you'll hear him talk about, you'll find really interesting because it is different. It's a different instrument than you've probably ever seen. He uses it in a different way than you might think as well. We'll also talk about being in the studio and what it's like to be a studio musician. But first, let's talk about the music industry numbers that just came out from the IFPI. IFPI stands for International Federation of Phonograph Industry, and basically what it is, it's the trade association for all the record labels in the world. And what they'll do is they'll, every year, they'll post about the global numbers, where all the money came in from in terms of music recording and how well we did. So it's kind of interesting because last year the numbers were down. They were worse than the year before. And we're at about $15 billion worldwide. It sounds like a lot of money, but at its peak, it was about twice as much. So, in fact, we're down quite a bit. Interesting thing is the fact that there were $7.7 billion made on physical product. Physical product meaning CDs and cassettes are hardly sold, but they are in some places, and vinyl, and just about anything else you can think of that's physical, you can hold in your hand, but it's mostly CDs. And really, it's more than 50% of the music business, the recorded music business. More than 50% still comes from CDs. Now, if you were to listen to everything you read and talk radio, when they talk about this and anything on television, you'd be led to believe that the CD is dead and buried. But it isn't. There are plenty that are still being sold, and I think there was 190-some million last year just in the United States, and that's what we could count. Don't forget, there's a lot of CDs that are sold that we don't even know about that aren't in this total here. For instance, if you were to sell some CDs on your website, that's not counted at all. There's no way to count it. So imagine all of the CDs that go unsold or go uncounted just from website sales. Same thing at a gig. If you sell over the course of a year, you sell a couple thousand, nobody counts those. So there's probably a lot more CDs being sold than what we know of, and there's a lot more money coming from it. And the point of the whole thing is there's still a huge, huge business in CDs, and it's something that you shouldn't discount. Discount at your own peril, in fact. Why should you have a CD? Well, first of all, you really can't get reviewed unless you have a CD. As much as everybody likes digital releases, it's not real in the eyes of a reviewer. And this is a blogger or this is somebody at a newspaper or magazine. Unless you have something physical in your hands that they can hold, it's not real. So you really need a CD for that, if for no other reason at all. The other thing is there's a whole part of the market that still buys CDs that we've seen. Now, in the past, it was a lot tougher to make CDs than it used to be. Like, for instance, what would happen would be, on the very lowest end, you'd have to order 1,000 copies. You'd order them up front, you pay up front, you wait until they're shipped. And if you weren't lucky, if it wasn't good, they'd sit in your garage or they'd sit in your closet or whatever until you sold them. And now we don't have to do that because there are a number of different services that will do them on demand. So if you only need 18 CDs, you can have them made. And they don't cost that much, somewhere from $1 to $1.75, depending on how many you order. But these come shrink-wrapped, looking like $1 million. And of course, they look like $1 million if your artwork looks great. But there's no reason to order 1,000 in advance or 500 in advance or however many you want unless you really need them. The good part about these companies is they'll even drop ship. So if, for instance, you sell some CD Baby off their website or Amazon, for instance, they'll even drop ship them for you. The biggest company doing this, the one I like, is called Kunaki.com. K-U-N-A-K-I, Kunaki.com. And they make it really easy for you to upload your audio files, to upload your artwork, and again, very easy to order. So don't discount CDs. They're still a bigger business than you ever thought. And it's something that we'll talk about in upcoming podcasts as well, because I think you'll find that, yes, they're going away, but they will be here for a while. The other thing I'd like to do is answer a question from Andre M. He says, I'm having trouble figuring out how to charge for my services. Can you give me some tips? I actually posted something on my Bobby Osinski blogspot, bobbyosinski.blogspot.com blog, and it's my big picture production blog. And I posted something about this, and really it was an excerpt from one of my books, Music Producer's Handbook. Here's the gist of it. There's three ways to charge, and it doesn't matter if you're a producer, if you're a studio musician, or trying to be a studio musician, if you know, you're doing anything for money, or and providing a service. Three ways to charge. One is you can charge on spec, and basically, it's when you get paid, I'll get paid. And, of course, people that are trying to do projects always want to get people to work with them on spec. And the number of those that pay off are really small. So don't ever expect to get paid if you're going to work on spec. Spec means speculation, by the way. What I've found is the only way to make sure you'll get paid is, one, have an agreement of some type. Because people will forget these things really quickly if you do something for free and all of a sudden they make a bunch of dough out of it and all of a sudden you won't get paid. They forget who you are. So have an agreement. It can be just something simple that's on paper that says I get X amount when this happens. And what I would also suggest is charge more than your rate. So if you're used to getting $100 a song, for instance, charge $200. And the reason why you should get a premium is because you're doing this out of your pocket as well. So you should be compensated for that. So that's one way to do it. To charge for your time, you can charge on spec. The second one is a flat fee. And a flat fee is, for instance, okay, I'll engineer for you. I'll charge you $500 for the album. And the good part is you know you get $500. The bad part is this could drag out on and on and on. So if you think something's going to take 3 days, for instance, you're going to get $500 and you feel good about that, well, what happens if suddenly it drags on for 2 weeks? And of course, this can happen really easily where you have an artist that says, oh, I just don't like the way that first version came out. Let's do another version of it. Oh, let's do another one. I still don't like it. You know what? Let's not do that anymore. Let's do a different song instead. And the next thing you know, that $500 that you thought you were making $100 a day, all of a sudden you're making McDonald's wages. You're making $12.50 a day or something, $50 a day. And you'll find that people do take advantage of these things, but it is a way of, you know, at least knowing what you're going to get paid. And a way to basically eliminate that is to say, okay, you get $500 or X amount for 3 days of my time. And sometimes mixers, for instance, what they'll do is they'll say, I will mix a song for you and you get one remix or two remixes, but no more. because people can make you crazy on that. So, you know, if you make it open-ended, chances are you will be working on it for a long time. So the best thing is to put some sort of limitation. The third way is to have an hourly or daily rate. And that way, if it keeps on going and going, it doesn't matter because you're going to get paid. And a daily rate is a good way to do it, especially, you know, if you're in a studio and, you know, it's going to take you a day. And even if it doesn't take you a day, that's your rate. You basically set aside that whole day just to do this project. And if it only takes 2 hours, then it's too bad. That works in your favor. But you might want to say, okay, I get $100 a day. I get $200 a day. I get $500 a day, whatever it is. And then if the project continues to go beyond what you expected, at least you're going to get paid. So those are the three ways. You can either charge on spec, you can charge a flat fee, or you can charge an hourly or a daily rate, and just decide what you want up in front. And it's always best if you can sign some sort of an agreement, and even if it's really, really simple, you know, on a single sheet of paper that you draw up that just says, I get this and I will give you this for this amount. And that will usually help you a lot if there's any kind of disagreement later on down the line. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to hear from my guest, studio bassist Paul Ill. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com, and I'll be happy to answer them on the next podcast. We'll be right back. I'm here today with Paul Ill, bassist extraordinaire, and Paul has played with so many different people. Most recently, he was a key member of Linda Perry's studio band and did records with Pink and Alicia Keys, Christina Aguilera, Tina Turner, and he just finished up a Matt Sorum record, right? Matt Sorum, a former Guns N' Roses player, right?
Yeah, a very interesting record called Matt Sorum's Fierce Joy. Really proud of my work on it. He's playing guitar, singing. He played very little drums on it. It's a new chapter for him. I played a lot of fretless bass on it, which I hadn't done for a while, which was pretty nifty.
Well, how does that work? Do you bring a fretless bass with you all the time, or do people ask for it specifically?
In this set of circumstances, it was really wide open. It was a very creative endeavor, and it just manifested as part of the creative choices that people make when they're making a record. I usually bring 6 to 8 basses with me. Usually, unless they're very specific, I'll bring a whole truckload of stuff.
Does that include a bass amp as well?
Yes, I usually bring an Ampeg B15N 1974 in really good shape.
Do you always use it? Just out of curiosity, do you use both the amp and the direct?
Yeah, it's less than 50% now, the DI. I think the DI as a default for some people, it's about half. A lot of people, it's one amp. A lot of people, it's two amps now, two different amp sounds.
When you say two different amps, is that one clean, one dirty, or one bass, one treble? How do you decide on that?
One completely clean, pristine, and then one with a different character. It may be dirty. It just might be a different sound, a different variety of clean. One might be giving them something that they want that is not present on the perfect track. Usually the perfect track for most stuff that is song oriented. And what I mean by that, if the intention is to make a recording that will sound really good in a variety of idioms where everybody is serving the song, my usual default is an old P bass. It's a 66 neck and a 62 body that was sold in 1966 as a factory second with labella flat wound strings in through an Ampeg B15N played with my fingers. But it can get as extremely strange as a Hofner P-Bass played with a felt pick. direct, or it could be my jazz bass with round wound strings, which has a Dark Star clone of an old Hagstrom Guild bisonic pickup. So that bass is basically a dead replica of John Paul Jones's bass with a tractor bass pickup added to it. So it's a kind of also a dead replica, pretty close to Barry Oakley's bass. And with a thumb pick, very bright through a Marshall guitar amp. It could go anywhere.
I remember you telling me for a while that you were using a pick on a lot of sessions, and that was kind of like the trend at the time. Has that gone back the other way, or is that still popular that you get asked to play with the pick?
What happens is, usually, if somebody doesn't say, wow, it's great, leave it right there, it's perfect. I believe in the Brian Eno dictum, where you just do the next appointed thing, you just plug in, you leave the settings where they are, even if they look weird, you don't adjust your tone knob, you don't adjust your, well, I that's wrong. I reflexively always open the tone knob or the volume and the tone up all the way on every bass that I own. I have specific settings that are optimum delivery to the signal chain, which are just full out. But the amplifiers and stuff and whatever else you may be using, just plug it in and see what it sounds like. If it's good, just go. And then if everybody's saying, wow, this is great, you have to develop a sense of, A, is it appropriate to say, hey, I think we can make it even better if we change something, or just sitting there going, great, that let's move forward. They're happy with this part of their thing they're going on. Because if you're sitting in a room with a rhythm section, you don't want to slow things down necessarily if things are sounding great. You don't want to change something that may completely change the sonic image or the feeling in the room. And also sociologically, you don't necessarily want to stop the momentum just to improve what you're doing because you think it's a good idea or you hear it in your head. So you develop a sense of that. And if they say, I don't know, man, I don't know if it's right, then you go, well, I've got this. I think, are you going for something more with more character that draws more attention to itself? Let's try this instrument with round wound strings, and let's try a grittier sound with a different amplifier, or let's make it grittier with a pedal, right? I was recently reading in your Ken Scott book about the TikTok bass, so I was going to do my research and listen to the White Album today as part of my fun listening. I'm driving to a session today, and that's going to be my fun thing because I don't have to prep. I don't have to listen to anything on the way to this session. I already know what I'm getting into. So,
yeah, for those of you listening that don't know what a TikTok bass is, it was a Nashville expression for when a regular four-string bass was doubled with the six-string bass. And the Beatles loved that sound, and they did it on several of their records as well. But it's a cool sound, definitely. It fills things out. And I know you're a big believer of six-string basses, of baritone guitars, so you have a lot of those as well, right?
Yes, I have my eye on a reissue Fender six-string bass right now that was made in China that's at a friend of mine's store, and I'm plotting how to get it in my clutches. I have three baritone guitars that I use as six-string basses that are tuned to B. Two of them are long scale. One is acoustic, long scale. And for six-string bass, I use a piccolo bass with essentially 30-inch scale basses strung with piccolo bass strings, and I double them a lot with that. That tends to work for me.
Well, let's talk about that for a while. You're a big proponent of the piccolo bass, and you're perhaps the proponent right now, the forward force of that whole piccolo bass movement. So how did that happen?
I was in a position where I write a lot of songs and I write with a lot of different people, and I had a body of work that people were encouraging me to manifest, and I had seen my peers and other people put a band together and play their instrument, play guitar, bass, or drums, or keyboards, and step out front and sing. And it was always really neat to see my friends do that. And I just had a revelation one morning. I was sleeping and I just shot up straight out of bed. And it dawned on me to convert the entire repertoire to piccolo mace. And I was bemused by the notion, wow, this is going to be a trip. So I secured a Vox Panther bass, just like the first one I ever owned, the first bass I ever owned. And I got some piccolo strings and started this adventure, which has led me to, at current count, I have 6 piccolo basses, one of which is a double neck. It's a regular 34-inch scale bass and a 30-inch scale on a pine body. It weighs about 11 pounds, and it's really cool.
That is very cool, I got to say. I don't think I've ever seen a double neck bass, or at least one, you know, with the piccolo and a regular four string. That's quite unique.
Well, it's pretty new.
It was custom made for you, right?
It's custom made. It has 2 Darkstar pickups and 2 Fender humbucking pickups on it, and it has a Ricosound output on it, so I can split it to 2 different amplifiers, or I can sum it to 1 amp. And we're putting a buffer circuit in it so that when it's in the middle position, the output remains the same. A weird phenomenon happens when you put it in the both necks on at the same time. It reduces the output of both necks. So we're fixing that.
Okay, so you say that there's a Ricosound. Ricosound is basically stereo, a stereo output on a guitar that Rickenbacker came up with a number of years ago. They're maybe the first people to come up with a stereo guitar that kind of worked. But do you have that connected so one bass is going to one amp, or one neck is going to one amp and one neck is going to the other? Is that the way that's connected, or is it connected in stereo?
The way I do it is I use a TRS male cable, a standard stereo quarter-inch plug that splits to 2 mono quarter-inch plugs. They go into 2 separate signal chains if I want to use 2 different amplifiers. So it's dual mono. The Ricosound, I have a Rickenbacker 4003 that does the same thing. And what the neck pickup goes to one amp and the bridge pickup goes to another. That's how it works.
Oh, got it. Got it.
And, okay. At least on the basses, maybe different on the guitars. I don't know. But that, I do that, or I come off of the mono output into one pedal board into one amplifier.
Okay.
And the amplification for the piccolo bass is an odyssey in and of itself that took about 2.5 to 3 years with a very patient tech.
Well, I should mention that the trick with you, it's way, way different than most people playing a piccolo bass or what you might think, because Paul plays it with a slide. And you're an excellent slide player. You've been doing that for a long time. But to play the piccolo bass as a lead guitar, almost as a lead instrument with the slide, that's the unique part of the whole thing. That's, you know, something that I don't think anybody else does.
I do know that in traditional African music, there were 1-stringed instruments, 2-stringed instruments, 3-stringed instruments that were manipulated with a device. It didn't. I don't know if it went on somebody's 3rd finger or pinky or 2nd finger, like the great slide guitar players that have manifested, or if they played it like a Hawaiian slack key guitar, like you would play a pedal steel with a bar. Probably similar to that technique. So I think the idea of playing piccolo bass as a songwriting instrument, it made it much more easy for me to articulate my ideas to people on the fly than it did by setting down a bass and picking up a guitar. One of the reasons I built the double neck was for that reason. We're going to build a 2nd double neck which is going to be a piccolo bass and a six-string guitar.
Oh, probably. Cool.
Right, for songwriting purposes, not for performance purposes. That was addressed by the secret elves that build these instruments. They don't want anybody to know who they are, for obvious reasons. It's quite a journey building these things. But anyway, the piccolo bass, because it's 30-inch scale, I'm using short scale instruments and D'Addario piccolo strings for now. There are some custom string makers that I may investigate that offer more gauges. What happens is the physics of it is such that two things need to be addressed. The string is longer and bigger, so there's more physical energy going to a stomp box or an amplifier. So if you use it in the guitar signal chain, everybody goes, wow! Like if you use like a regular stomp box, like an OCD or a Klon Centaur or whatever you're using, it responds differently. It goes, whoa, what is this? Guitar amplifiers with EL34s made to emulate Marshall Mark IIs from the late, early 70s tend to really like them. Amplifiers that are my favorite amplifier for playing in the guitar register with a piccolo bass is any clone of a Marshall Major with KT88s. I use a divided by 13 TBL200. And any clone of a Marshall super bass like Duane Allman or Jimi Hendrix used. I quite like those. And I also like Marshall Mark IIs or any clone that's well made. All of them are great. And they all really like piccolo bass. However, I switch between the guitar register and the bass register with stomp boxes that are designed to do that, made by Digitech and Morpheus. I use the Digitech DT9 and I use the Morpheus drop tune pedal, and I'm also using their capo pedal to go up because of tuning and vocal considerations when playing piccolo bass and singing or wanting to jam with people or just be able to switch keys on the fly. So in the bass register, what I also do is I play bass guitar on a piccolo bass, which is a completely different sound. In my own music, which I do under the name of Paul Ill Truly Blessed, I switch between the guitar and the bass register with the piccolo bass, and I make it a point of putting disclaimers on all the recordings, just like Queen used to say no synthesizers on the first couple of Queen albums. I put no traditional guitars or basses were used in the creation of this recording, this piccolo bass only, which kind of raises a few eyebrows because people go, well, what's going on here? And then they take a look at the pedal board and the two amplifiers and the amplifier switching, and all the speakers are very high wattage, highly efficient speakers made by Celestion. Everything is, the 15s are 150 watts, the 10s are 300 watt 10s, and the 18 inches an 800 watt 10. They're basically PA speakers in Marshall and divided by 13 cabinets on either side of the stage. So people have recorded us or seen me live, I like to play just with a drummer, just as a two-piece, so that the attention, shall I say, is on how to do something minimal in the style of John Lee Hooker. And of course, more contemporary visions for this would be the original White Stripes stuff and Black Keys before they went four-piece. And flat duo jets who don't get a lot of props, and do a duo that sounds really big, right? And the next innovation, if I may dare say, call it an innovation that popped into my head while sleeping, and I woke up and went, oh yeah, try that next, which will make the elves that helped me create the hybrid instruments probably scratch their heads, but I have a feeling that if you have a piccolo bass with piccolo strings and you add a P bass pickup to it, but you put it on its own output and you kill the top half of the pickup for output only, but you make it to where it still is a humbucking pickup, but you just it's not sending any signal from the two high strings, then the two low strings can go to an octave device that will drop it low. So anything that you're playing, just your two low strings are playing in the bass register. And you've got the voice of the piccolo bass on four strings. So it would be like, this is not a new idea. There are lots of, piezo type pickups where you can do individual assignments across the bridge pickup and, Roland and all these companies make things where you can pan them stereo. You can send two strings to an effect that you don't send two strings to. It's not an original idea. I think though, putting it on a four stringed instrument might help me. I might for certain songs and certain applications, which, at a truly blessed gig, I may play six songs on three different instruments and use the Morpheus pedals to change keys during the song so that the one instrument it presents enough, a broad enough musical language to keep people interested in what I'm doing for like 30 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a unique sound, and I've heard you play, and we've played together with it, and it's very cool. You definitely are onto something that's quite unique. I want to come back to the studio for a second.
Sure.
So let's go back to the beginning. What was your first studio date? Can you remember?
My first recording session?
The first studio date where someone hired you to come in and play.
The very first time I got paid to play music, and it was going to a recorded media? Paid gig?
No, as a studio player. Someone said, come in and play on this recording.
Oh, wow. This really dates me. Well, there was a company in Florida, in North Florida, that was in competition with KTEL Records. And I was a freshman in college at Florida State University. I was, I hadn't turned 19 yet. I was still 18. And I was hired to play recordings that were sold only on 8-tracks in the Southeast.
8-track cartridges.
8-track cartridges. I have a few if you're interested in any photographs of these. What are they? They're archaeological relics. In fact, right behind me are the first four Led Zeppelin records, Black Sabbath, Paranoid, and Hendrix 8-tracks right over there. Anyway, we did recordings that were advertised at point of purchase in like stores that were in competition with 7-Eleven, like, and truck stops that said, as done by the original artists, which means just like we've cleared this. And I did a lot of stuff. I did the first three Robin Trower records. I did Isley Brothers, a lot of funk, a lot of soul. And we had a team that did it, and they were all from Southern California and Okinawa, ironically. They were Japanese Americans or Okinawan Americans and guys from Watts and Compton that this manager had moved out to Florida, and their bass player had quit and gone back to L.A. So they had an ad up in the local music store, and I joined their band. And we did a lot of recording. We did, my guess is we did somewhere between 40 and 50 albums.
Wow.
So that was a real education because everybody was 10 years older than me. And it was a very interesting time. It was a different planet.
Yeah. What Paul is talking about is back then there used to be kind of knockoffs of the hits. Whatever the hit of the day, there was a sound-alike album that would come out. And that's what you're talking about. You played on a bunch of sound-alikes, essentially. They don't do that so much anymore. They might do some for kids, but it's not like it used to be. There would be late-night ads on television to buy these things, buy albums and everything. Back in the vinyl days, vinyl LP days.
Well, yeah, ours were 8-track only. They didn't bother to press ours into vinyl. And they were, the guy that ran the company was in direct competition with a company called KTEL Music. And KTEL was the big sound-alike company. And then the KTEL started getting into leasing masters, basically. Yeah. And KTEL then started doing compilations and stuff. But it was a lot of fun because we were also a touring, gigging band. And it was a very, very exciting time for me. It was a lot of fun. And we had a machine. We had a recording studio set up in a warehouse in Tallahassee, outside of Tallahassee, Florida, with a glass tinting business as well, in the same warehouse that the manager owned. And we would learn the songs, do our homework. Each of us would transcribe them. We would rehearse, and then we would say, "We are ready. Let's track this." And we had one of the very, very early Tascam multitracks and the matching console, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And the engineer producer that was tasked with the responsibility of recording us was very reasonable about sharing his information with me about what he was doing. And I've always had an interest in that side of things. And it was great. It was a lot of fun. Back then I only owned one bass. I owned a Fender Telecaster bass, 1968, with the small low output pickup on it. And everything was done, every recording was done with that bass with Roto sound strings. All 40 to 50 of those sound like straight to eight track stuff we did. And we were recording, I believe, on 1-inch 8-track, if I'm not mistaken.
With the bass amp, or did you go direct?
When we recorded, my guess, because we didn't, this is crazy, we didn't have headphones. This is going to freak everybody out in the contemporary DAW world. We had no keyboard player, three guitars, bass, drums, two lead singers who both played percussion, congas and timbales. And so we would figure out a way to do "Who's That Lady" by the Isley Brothers one day, and then "Shame the Devil" by Robin Trier the next day. And then maybe like a Gatto Barbieri track and grab a sax player from Florida State or something.
Wow.
We didn't have any headphones, and I would be shocked if we had a direct box. I believe everything was mic'd up, and we just played live in the room, and the singers sang it live.
Wow.
I think we did any overdubs. They may have overdubbed lead vocals. My memory is obfuscated by time. This is 40 years ago. And it's also obfuscated by lifestyle choices that we would make daily back then.
That's a nice way to put it.
Part of the plan, you know, it was part of the fun, part of the formula back then.
Well, when you go into a session today, what makes a session really click? What makes a session fun for you?
Fun?
Yeah.
Oh, what makes a session fun is if everybody shows up with a positive mental attitude and there's a plan, and everybody, if preparation is required, everybody's prepped. They were given fair notice about anything. Like if they needed to make charts and learn the song or transcribe the song or listen to an MP3. And what makes it fun is if the muse is best served. If whoever's running the show, the producer, the artist, is making choices that are in the best interests of the music and not necessarily the best interests of an agenda outside the music. But positive mental attitude is crucial.
I know one of the things that when I've worked as a producer, one of the hardest decisions is to make sure that you don't go past the best take. And I know when I talk to other studio musicians, they always tell me that's their biggest frustration when they feel like there's a great take that you're asked to do 10 more after that. And it's like, well, wait a second. We really nailed it way back there.
Yeah. Well, I concur. And in addition to that, I do work with one producer frequently who, after he has the take, he always says to me and anybody else that's on the date, I've been on a ton of different dates with him. Because he owned his own indie label for a while, and he's done his own music, all kinds of different things, where he'll always say, "Okay, forget everything I've told you. We've got what I want. Do whatever you guys want to do. Just play the song at the same tempo and the same key, and just do whatever you want to do." And then occasionally he'll send you an email saying, "You know what I did? You guys, I took the drummer's bridge idea, where he didn't go to the floor tom-tom, and he didn't go to halftime. And I built a new bridge on that, and it's great. Thank you."
Wow.
Right? And I've been on sessions with really, really, really big producers that will say occasionally, wait a minute, what are you guys doing? We were just tuning up and jamming. Okay, roll tape. Everybody's a writer on this one. Let's go. I can turn this into a song, or, you know, me and the artist will work on this after you guys split. And then we'll just do what we were doing, capturing that moment. That's why I maintain my own recording studio, for that very reason, so that I can have a room where I can say to people, let's just play and let's not worry about product or intention other than the sheer joy of music.
Yeah, you'd think that that would be, you know, just part of being a musician. And it is in a lot of places, but in L.A. it becomes so very commercial many times, where people get a taste for what could happen if you get a hit, or just, you know, get a couple writer's credits, and, you know, the mindset changes.
Well, let's not fault L.A. I will say that the same is true in Sweden. And I would say the same is true in London, and I would say the same is true in New York. And quite a few people have a lot of success move here for the weather. And I know a couple of English, very prominent English producers and engineers that will swear to you that microphones and acoustic instruments, pianos, guitars, and drums and microphones sound better in Southern California because of the absence of humidity. They'll bring an old Neumann microphone here and let it dry out before they use it, and they'll swear to you that there's a difference, and that pianos sound better here, and that drums sound better here, and people play better here because the weather's better.
Well, I'll give them that it does sound different. I don't know if that's better, but it does sound different. But
yeah,
I'll give that to you.
Yeah, what's
the worst session that you ever did? And you don't have to tell me any specifics about who the artist was or anything, but just the general. Is there a session that sticks out to you that was just so nasty?
Well, yeah, the first one that jumped into my mind was a triple scale Union bass last overdub session with a very famous hitmaker producer. And we got set up, we got a sound, and the producer said to me, what I want you to do is give me that boo at the beginning of this song that's going to announce the tune, like I know you can do. What this individual meant was they wanted something like one of the famous Motown drum fills, or they wanted Carol K, Mr. Tambourine Man, boom, dum, dum. What this individual sang to me was 1, 2, 3, 4, boom. They sang a glissando down, what sounded like a low string on beat 4. Thank God this producer always has a DAT rolling. A DAT to this day still uses DAT to document everything.
Yeah.
Right? And they take numbers. The assistant engineer has many jobs to do in this studio. And one of the things the assistant engineer does for this producer is write down what started, when the track started and everything. So I went, okay, here we go. Producer counts me in. I go, doom, just like the producer saying. Talk back, no. And I went, okay. Let's put it on a different beat. I went through every possible 1, 2, 3, 4, boom. 1, 2, 3, boom, boom. 1, you know, whatever. I did different strings. I did up the neck. I did down the neck. Finally, the producer slammed their fists on the console. So I went, holy smokes, what was that, right? I saw everybody in the glass jump back from this individual. Slammed her fist on the tap, its fist on the talk back. And said, explicative, 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 I don't know what's wrong with you today. This is horrible. Stormed out of the room and left us all sitting in the studio, which this individual owns. And I went, wow, I guess I'm fired for life. That didn't go too well. But of course, I was in massive fight or flight. It was pretty scary. And
how did you figure out what?
Well, here's what happened. The engineer's a very, very good friend of mine. He said to me, you were doing exactly what this individual sang every time this individual counted it in. And it never changed. The first thing you did was exactly what the individual was singing to you. You had no choice. You did your best, right? Smash cut to about 3 days later, It was a phone call. No, an email first. Come in the studio. I want to talk to you. I thought I was getting fired. I came in. This individual said, really sorry. Saw my doctor. Got a diagnosis. I'm in serious, serious crisis, health crisis. I'm going through something profound, and it's affecting my emotional self. And I'm really, really sorry that happened. They played me the DAT. You did it perfectly. My perceptions were inaccurate. And we moved on. But that was probably the worst, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was circumstances beyond anyone's control, and that individual didn't realize that they had a physical malady that was affecting them emotionally and their ability to perceive stuff, which has since been rectified.
Yeah. Well, that's the way those things go. You don't know if you're doing right or wrong, and if someone, especially under the microscope of the studio, it intensifies so much when somebody lashes out like that, or even, you know, gets nasty. It just makes it all the worse. So anyway, Paul, thank you so much for
being the best session.
Okay, how about that? What's the best session?
Probably there's three, but I'm going to go with getting to play with Tina Turner. For Tina, cut three tracks for her. The producer kept me and the drummer on his own dime in London for an extra day. And he said, I want you guys here when she hears this, just in case. And we thought, wow, she doesn't like it. We'll have to do it again. Wrong key, whatever, right? That was not his motive. He had a more positive outlook than that. And sure enough, he called us. I was at a coffee shop around the corner from the studio, and he said, she likes this so much, she wants to do it live with you guys.
Wow.
So I got to go back to the studio and play three songs live with Tina Turner in the studio, track them, you know, a couple of takes of each one, top to bottom. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah, that's great to play with a legend like that.
Be in the room with her while she sang.
Yeah. Okay, is that, you got another one? You said there were three.
Playing impromptu, off the cuff, slow blues with Mick Taylor and Jerry Groom live to two track that you produced. And I'm not being aggrandizing here. I'm not blowing smoke up your skirt. That was definitely a high point. Playing with a Rolling Stone and Duane Allman's protege through an API console live to two track with Matt Apps on drums.
Yeah, that actually was a great session. That whole session, there was a magic to it.
Yep. The unplanned song that we did called Mixed Jam, that moment was, I always listen to that to reaffirm my faith in the fundamental power of music and traditional American R&B and stuff. And I play it for people, and boy, do they get pissed off, especially guitar players. They get grumpy because it's good. The third most memorable session that pops into mind today happened very recently. We got to the opportunity to do the end credit song for a film called Any Day, which is the new Sean Bean, Eva Longoria film. And we were graced with the opportunity to record a cover of I Shall Be Released, and it was we recorded it with our new A team at our new studio, and this is a band called Disreputable Few, and we are I played bass on it, and it was the 66P bass into the B15 with an Audix A6 microphone into a universal mic pre reissue with no compression, flat wound strings, three takes live, no baffling, no separation, everybody playing live. We used the second take. They overdubbed a lead vocal, a background vocal, and a slide guitar part. We were done in 2 hours. The music supervisor, the producer, and the director of the film were in shock because they'd been sitting in front of workstations with people and composers. And they went, how did this just happen? What is this? And we strongly recommended they watch the Muscle Shoals documentary and said, that's what we're about. Rockstar, I recommend you watch Song of the South, too, about Duane Allman's career.
Well, you know, when you have really great musicians all together and everyone is focused, as you say, it's amazing what can happen in such a short period of time. And again, most people don't get to experience that. And it's something that every musician, every producer, every songwriter should once in their life.
Well, also, it was a pretty darn good song.
Well, yeah, that helps a whole lot, too.
And hats off to the recording engineer producer, Chris Wanzer. No name drop, but really, he does deserve a lot of credit for that because he mixed it on the fly. You know, he was, and he knew the room, he knew the players, he made his mic choices. He and I showed up a couple hours early to get things sorted. Actually, he showed up a couple hours early. I didn't.
Paul, this has been great. Thank you very much for your time. Very informative, as always. And I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. Everybody have a wonderful day. Peace.
That was really cool hearing from Paul. Of course, words of wisdom and a lot of cool things that he's doing with this piccolo bass. And again, you won't hear that from too many places because it's pretty totally unique. You can find out more about Paul. You'll go to his Facebook page, and it's facebook.com/paul.ill. That's facebook.com/paul.ill. And I think he should have a website up pretty soon, paulill.com. I'm not sure if that's available or not, but take a look and see. If not, just go to his Facebook page. Thank you for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, you can hear the archived episodes there. You might want to go to bobbyosinski.com and check out the links to my blogs. I have two blogs, one on music industry and another one that's Music 3.0, and another one that's a music production blog. It's my big picture blog. And I also write for Forbes, so you might want to look at that as well. You'll also find links to my coaching programs there, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter. And you can also read some excerpts from my books and get some free chapters as well. This is Bobby Osinski. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you the next time.